Now, I think I've said enough for today, and over to you.
I was wondering, in discussing theology and science, is it strictly analogy that we're dealing with here? It's a common thing to say that in Christian circles that you can't find God in nature. To go out into nature and study nature, you won't find God there. And yet you say the scientists are calling out to God because they somehow seem to be approaching God through nature. That was one question, and one that's not connected with that.
Could you speak louder so other people can hear? The question is whether there are analogies in nature, and my concern with analogies in nature, which we can use in knowledge of God.
Yeah.
Is that it? Well, let me deal with that first.
Yeah.
You have another one?
Yeah, I have another
one. Or is it cognate to it?
No.
Yeah. Well, now here, science has also taught us to think quite radically in a new way about analogy. And after all, this had been done earlier on. You see, if you do not think, if you think in terms of a dualist way of thinking, then you separate form from being, and therefore how can any form relate to being unless in some secret way, apart from the distinction, they are participant in one another. That is a problem. But there's also this problem that the whole historic doctrine of analogy, apart from certain aspects of Plato, that have come down to us, the concept of analogy comes from music. Let's say, comes from the doctrine of proportions of sound, but all on one level, you see. So the analogies relate to interrelations at one level. Now, strictly speaking, this is not the case. St. Thomas Aquinas taught us that, properly speaking, analogy is in this form: as A is to B, so C is to D. But is this all on one level? Now, in his earliest book, the Scriptum, Super Sententiis, he's put it rather like that. There's A is to B on one level, so C is to D on another level. But then he couldn't connect those up. And so he evened them up onto one level. Now, Duns Scotus came along and said, if you think of analogies on one level, then there's a logical relation between them. But strictly speaking, analogy is not something you find between A and B on one level. The analogy is concerned of what relates to A across a level to another level. You have to think in terms of two levels, at least three levels. Scotus says many levels. So that analogy is really a cross-level reference. A cross-level reference. I'll give you an example from science. This is part of the whole debate between Einstein and Bohr. See, if you take the kind of connections you have in quantum theory and you interpret them in terms of Newtonian mechanics, mechanical connection, on one and the same level, everything becomes absurd and contradictory. So you have to interpret them in terms of different levels. And there is some relation, Bohr calls it a correspondence principle, between the two levels. But that doesn't mean to say there's a one-to-one correspondence at all. So that, strictly speaking, analogy then means that you don't relate that directly like that. But, I may go back to Scotus again. Scotus anticipated the Gödelian theorems in which he held that if you have a complex of second intentions, namely propositions or statements, then at least two or three of them have to be primary intentions, which you understand from a different level. Otherwise, this has no meaning whatsoever. Let's say, no syntactics contains its own semantics. I mean, this is really anticipation of the Gödelian theorem. So that any analogy here is not a one-to-one level, but as B, for example, is syntactically defined on that level, it is related to, let's say, C, as that is syntactically defined on that level at these points. Now, that is the way in which all scientific analogies work today, and that shatters the idea of all the problems. Particularly, nearly all the books that have worked with these problems of analogy have done so in the old medieval or post-medieval form, and now we know, really, you can't think in that way. The only person really in the West, I think, who anticipated this was Scotus. All the dear answer are dear Aquinas in his first book, where he proposes then his form of analogy and proportionality. You're not then comparing A to B with C to D, you're comparing the way in which A and B are related at one level to the way in which C and D are related at another level. Now that is precisely, in some respects, what Scotus is after. Now looked at it this way, how are we to think of analogy in science? You cannot therefore relate any scientific concept by a direct one-to-one correspondence with any theological concept. But if we have all scientific concepts, put it this way, are defined in terms of the whole coherence of creation, but the whole universe of light is to be understood as having a created or a contingent correspondence to uncreated light of God. Now in that connection of contingent relation, we can understand analogy. But that because of contingence, you cannot argue from the world to God. You may use the word the concept of sufficient reason. You can't argue logically. All the classical notions of, for example, the five so-called ways are all attempts to argue logically from this world to God. You can't do that. But you might be able to argue that if this really is intelligible, it has a sufficient ground beyond it. But if this world is contingent, then any argument from contingent, from a world, as I pointed out the other day, that's created out of nothing, any argument from the world comes to nothing. So that if it's contingent, then any contingent argument breaks off. It breaks off, it points beyond itself, but it cannot tell you anything beyond itself. So if you start with any analogy of science in nature, that's all it can do. But if any analogy in nature is illuminated by the light of God, then you can use it in that sense. Now this is precisely the point that Einstein made, I mentioned, that you cannot argue from geometry to physics, nor can you take your physics and crush it into Euclidean geometry. You have to take your Euclidean geometry and put it in the heart of physics when the whole thing becomes changed and you have it's integrated. Now in this integration, then certain geometric patterns have their meaning beyond themselves. They are incomplete, they have their meaning beyond themselves, and that's how one has to understand any analogy. So in this way, I think the whole problem of analogy is radically cleared up by the sheer immense struggle and rigor of modern thought over physical nature. Now I think that we theologians have to allow our minds to go through all that schooling, and we have to learn what St. John's Cross would call an unknowing of a lot of our ideas. Now later on we shall see, when we come to discuss the Fathers again, that the relation of any images that we use to the realities to which they refer are imageless. Now that's a difficult concept, but we'll try and work at it next week.
I just wanted to ask one quick question about paradigm shift from Newtonian to Einstein. Is there the possibility that there could be another shift which would collapse this whole course?
I think that here if you look at it formally, you might think this would be the case. But look at it like this. All previous science to our own day has taken place in dualist frameworks. And here you have a non-dualist framework. Now under the non-dualist framework, we've been able to establish the truth of earlier science, even the truth of Greek science and Greek mathematics up to a point, within its own limits. And Newton, you see, can now be... Newton is not thrown over by any manner of means. Newton can be deduced from the level of relativistic physics in such a way that Newton's concepts are established more securely than ever on a limited basis. So we now see that there took place with Newton something utterly irreversible. Theology, science can never go back upon it. Now the idea that all science is relativist, that's nonsense. Science proceeds always upon foundations that are securely based. When you criticize them at a later period, the truth in them that touch with reality is not so known, but established all the more surely. Now, if it should be the case that we advance beyond Einstein to another paradigm shift, the same thing would happen with Einstein. But remember, here we don't no longer work with a dualist concept, we work with a unitary concept. And to this I would put that, take special relativity. I mean, that can no more be changed than 2 times 2 equals 4 can be changed. But we have problems. You can't add the speed of light to the speed of light. If you do, you only get the speed of light. So if you add 1 plus 1, you only get 1. But see, that's already been anticipated by Einstein. So, and the extraordinary thing about Einstein's equations are, they predict their own limits. That's why they predict a black hole. That's why they predict the fact that of the event horizon where our Einsteinian knowledge comes to its limits. So that in these circumstances, it's very difficult to think that there will be any radical shift from an Einsteinian outlook which would be involved as big a change as Einstein evolved to, say, to Newton. Here we seem to be in touch with the invariant structures of reality in a way we've never been in touch with before, so that that governs and controls almost everything else. And that's why science has reached such an exciting point, because we've not only pressed our finger, as it were, in quantum theory, almost into the very points of creation itself, but we've also pressed our question to the very boundary of being, and at every point we reach, we find basically the same ultimate, where relativity, the equations of relativity ultimately hold. And that's quite staggering.
Is it possible, I am again addressing the discrepancy between those who want to unify field theory and those who want to make room for the uncertainty principle, is it possible that these are two paradigms which point to two different perspectives on reality, the one maybe taking more into account what we understand theologically to be the bifurcation of judgment, the mystery of sin, which we really cannot account for in any kind of a unified picture? Is it possible that maybe the quantum theorists are onto something that maybe we ought never to explain, the mystery of sin, and yet for which there can be no explanation in unified field theory either?
Well, I think these are two different things, really. The uncertainty principle, as I said yesterday, or indeterminism, has been wrongly formulated. It's been formulated within a structure of thought, a frame of thought where we work with determinism. Now, we've got to get away from indeterminism, determinism, chance, necessity. We've got to get out of that whole syndrome if we're really going to understand quantum theory. And I think Einstein is dead right there. Now, Einstein's problem, however, was that he thought there ought to be an ultimate unity of the particle and the field, and the dualism of the particle and the field was certainly affecting the problem of quantum theory. Now, it seems to me that dualism of the particle and the field affected quantum theory was still tied up with the fact that locality in space and time in regard to, say, a particle was from one perspective defined in Newtonian geometric ways, and another way which is quite different to it. Now, what Einstein really demanded was a thorough relativization of it. Now, if there's a thorough relativization of it, this would mean the bringing of particle and field closely together, and you wouldn't get that problem. Nor would you get Bohr's problem of complementarity. Now, I don't think myself that it's possible ultimately to eliminate the spatial aspect of the particle or the time undulatory aspect of the particle. I don't think you can do that. But granted that Einstein is right, as we think in space-time, we have to think of them somehow together. Now, that is one issue. I think that myself, Einstein is dead right, ultimately, that we still have problems here, but certainly particle theory is moving toward him, away from the Copenhagen Göttingen form of it, and therefore away from the ad hoc concepts, as I call them, of complementarity, which still hold in them Kantian presuppositions of subject and object, and of the fact that our observing, our measuring instruments obstruct us from knowing. Now, to a certain extent, that is true. Whether that is evil or not, I wouldn't say. I couldn't say. I don't believe it is there. evil may come in another form, and this is questionable, also in forms of entropy. But then this takes us into thermodynamics. Now, the other question you raise about unified field theory means that really raises the question whether, if relativity defines the universe as a whole, and the whole universe is a coherent whole, then we ought to be able, in our science, to bring gravitation theory, thermodynamics, and quantum theory together. Now, if you can bring all these together, and this is a question I raised in a lecture I gave at Bern 2 years ago, then you would then have a universe, ultimately, that is self-explaining and self-supporting. We don't have that. Therefore, on principle, it seems to me ultimately impossible to attain a unified field theory, but you might attain a unified field theory if you work with an extra-cosmic or a metacosmic factor. That is to say, if you throw God into the equation. But you cannot throw God into the equation in the Newtonian way, in which you can put God among the other equations as though he were just one, as it were, mathematical equation along with the others, you see. Therefore, here we then have to work with meta-levels. Now, in this sense, therefore, I think we can see that we can have a unified... You see, put it this way, we have experiences on one level which we cannot think coherently. We cannot think consistently. But we can only think them consistently if we think of them from a higher level where they are open to them at their boundary conditions. This is what I spoke about yesterday as the principle of integration from above, you see. Now, it seems to me that all modern science really demands that. All right, then. If that is so, then it really tells us that ultimately a unified field theory is only possible if in some form you expect, you apply the Gödelian theorems to the universe as a whole or to science as a whole or to the way we unify our various theories as a whole.
Do I see you sort of wanting to move in that direction then?
No, why? You can't help it.
Well, that still leaves that one part of my question in which I suppose it's a fake statement that we somehow say that there is such a thing as the mystery of sin, or the mystery of evil, you might say. But how does that...
Well, now that is a... I think we've got to come at that quite a different way. You see, it's very difficult, you see, in any scientific way, let's say with your concern to, you believe there's order in the universe, and you allow the order in the universe, because of your commitment to order the universe, you insist that there must be order in this set of events. Now, therefore, although a scientist is unable to explain how this set of events is coherently, rationally connected, he nevertheless doesn't give up the ghost and say, oh, the universe is pointless or incoherent. No, he believes that there is order. And that from some perspective, some point of view, at some level, he can see the order here. Now, he must think in that way. Therefore, he cannot think, by his very nature, of question of evil any more than he can, from his point of view, think out contingents. So this is the point I've argued in the book, I've Divine Contingent Order. The scientist, therefore, has to struggle with the fact that his very way of thinking is constantly ruling out contingents, and yet then he's cutting off the branch that he's sitting on, and therefore today, when science is reaching this point, science cannot be pure science without dialogue with theology, to hold them to contingents. Now, what about the problem of evil? Now, when Einstein said, "Raffiniert ist der Herrgott, aber boshaft ist er nicht," that God is very subtle and refined, sophisticated, but he's not malicious. Einstein would say, there's no evil in nature. Well, what does the Christian do? When you look into the face of Jesus Christ, at the cross of Christ, you know that God is unalterably opposed to all evil, physical evil as well as spiritual evil. It was physical bloodshed on the ground. It's a physical act, God in space and time. Therefore, face to face with Jesus Christ, we revolt at the idea of a tiger tearing a beautiful creature that God has made, the antelope, to pieces. We revolt at the idea of a child dying of cancer, something like that. So that here, where we believe that the universe comes from the love of God, that is it love that is in God that is the ultimate reason for the creation of the universe, that love, which is the power of all order, is opposed to any kind of physical or natural evil so-called. Now, I think we've got to think that out today. But then the question has to be raised, does natural science at any point, apart from the ecological chaos that the confusion of science with technology creates, does science at any point come up against issues where there is something quite disorderly? And this is and this says, how do we understand entropy? Now we're still in a point of reinterpreting this in terms of the thermodynamics of open systems. And I think that there is something here we have to feel after. But there's one other point where we can say to the scientist that you have a problem. I mentioned it yesterday. We're all free, but no one is free to escape from his self-will. You see, theologians fight and squabble, as we often say, in the way that scientists don't. But they do too. I have scientific friends who will not reveal, in even in an article, their discoveries because they know that some other scientists will pounce on it and put it out as their own, you see. Now, there is therefore in the scientific community a great deal of suspicion and squabbling and infighting, much more than we often realize, although the scientific community does work in a coherent way in which the way theologians do not. And from them, I think, we've got to learn this. But they have to learn from us, probably, that there is something here, I mentioned this yesterday, about the way in which sanctity, holiness, purity affects our minds and the way we think. A man like Einstein, who's completely given over to the objective reality or the truth as it's disclosed from nature, is utterly transparent to it. Quite remarkable in this kind of way.
Kind of relative to, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true.
Next to the top of the lecture, you were going to try in this lecture to use understanding of physical life to help us understand uncreated life. My question is, you went on to do that, like with the concept of life and the concept of death. Are you saying that the physical Einsteinian insights give us a better understanding of, say, the grace of God and, say, the parable of the prodigal son? Or is this just another resource that theology has failed to tap and we should be there?
Well, the point I'm making is this, that there are certain aspects in theology which contradict sharply our common sense. And not only common sense, but in the way in which our language, our human wisdom has accumulated over the ages, a lot of mistakes are in it. That's why I could never agree with these logical analysts. I used to tell my Edinburgh colleagues who were this that I couldn't believe that in the inspiration of common language, or in Wittgenstein, it's profit. Because common language is full of mistakes and errors, and you can't therefore build any philosophy on that. As because of our culture, there are lots of things that contradict us. Now, if theology contradicts that, we tend all the time to twist theology around to suit our common sense notions, you see. Now, the scientist finds the same question. So at certain points, he finds in the sheer obedience to, in a rigorous way, to what nature reveals itself, he has to upturn his scientific concepts. So, as I showed yesterday, he also works for justification by grace alone, so to speak. Now, at certain points, therefore, this contradiction in science, between science and our common conceptions, helps us to understand the gospel, which had already done exactly the same point. And so I thought that the constancy of light helps us to understand the faithfulness of God in this sense, and that the invariance of light helps us to understand the sheer impartiality of grace. The invisibility of light helps us to understand the invisibility of God. There's a difference here. I pointed out in regard to audibility and light. But take another example, which is I wrote a lecture. I was asked recently to give the Drew lecture on immortality. And I discussed this in relation to immortality and light. And I took one or two analogies in this kind of way. Now, take one difficult point. I thought of this last year when my dear mother died at the age of 97. Now, when she died, she went to be with Christ. Well, to be with Christ is the same as Christ to be with her. That's a Christ was present to her. She was in the parousia. Now remember, the New Testament doesn't speak about parousia in the plural. There's only one parousia that stretches from the incarnation to what we call the second advent, or the second parousia, the final parousia. Now, in some sense, therefore, that event when she died to be with Christ is coincident with the final coming again of Christ, the parousia, in some sense. Now, Einstein showed by the relativity of simultaneity that the same event can have, in our physical experience, at two different real-time scales. That's a staggering fact. It's terribly difficult to grasp, but at least here it shows that even physical experience, we have something rather similar on quite a different scale to the problem which theologically we're faced with here in the parousia. Now, we don't learn anything from science about Christ in the parousia, but this helps us to see that more clearly by destroying certain ideas we have which you want all the time to foist upon them. And that happened, you see, because in take Justin Martyr, I think, is probably the first to talk about parousiae, plural, and Justin Martyr also talks about en meso tes parousias, in the middle of the parousia. So because we can't understand it, we chop up the parousia, the first advent and the second advent, and that sort of thing, you see. And so when we start doing that, then we misunderstand. Take, for example, another point of misunderstanding. The New Testament never uses the term palingenesia, regeneration, or what goes on in this. Never once. Regeneration refers either to the incarnation or refers to the what we call the second coming. Now, what have we done to all that, you see? By chopping it up, we have changed the whole concept of regeneration, and therefore other problems follow with it. Suppose we don't do that and we really stick to the Bible. But we won't allow ourselves to stick to the Bible because we can't make sense of it otherwise. Now, and science helps us really to stick to the Bible, at least to listen to it even though it contradicts our common sense. That's what I'm happy about this.
Comment. I don't think you meant to imply when you talked about the truth of God, the exclusive ground of all other standards, his I am, I don't think you meant to exclude from that the dynamic interpretation of that I amness. The I shall be there might be a more adequate translation of the Hebrew verb. The truth of God is not a static thing, is what I think you would want to say. Don't.
Oh yes, I'm quite right, but I wouldn't agree that the Hebrew should be translated in that way. Probably both. This is the peculiarity of it. Now, when we come next week, we shall be dealing with the fact that the energeia of God is also enousios, so that God's being is in his act, and his act is in his being, so that the I amness of God is always a living, dynamic reality. That's taken for granted. The whole life of Jesus is the ego I me. Yeah, you're quite right to point that out.
I've got a question concerning the particles, movement of particles, and say now there is no real determined subject object causal relationship among them, and how some dissipate and die, a movement in. Say like at UCLA where a physics professor is doing work where he found a quark or whatever that is not noticeable except as a irregular movement. Say 20 years from now they discover a causal relationship in that. Would that have any effect on the dynamic theory of Einstein?
No, I don't think so. You see, the problem is that part of our problem still in apprehending the interrelation and so-called interchange and exchange and the containing one another of particles, because they use this kind of language, is that we still have at the back of our minds all the time the old habits where we try to think of them in terms of determinate causal relations and so on. So we create problems, we have to eliminate it. Let me put it this way. I was once speaking to the mathematical physicist in Edinburgh, now retired, Kummer, who was who was a pupil of Max Born, and we hadn't had him for a long time, and he said to me, I still find it very, very difficult to think in quantum theory. But the young people I now have come up, they have no difficulty. I'd say, there comes a stage when the very structure of our mind as we grow up changes. Now, I think that the shift that I've been speaking about will take a long time. The first cosmological change took about 400 years. The second one took 300 odd years. The present one has taken just over 100 years. But from Einstein, we've only had what? Since 1904. But now the tempo is greater. When I would give another 50 years before quite a different way of thinking is seeded into our young people. Now, a good deal of this depends, however, on whether the old habits of thought are preserved by the social sciences, because they become the deposits of the old deterministic concepts. And until they learn to change and really think in terms of systems theory or dynamic relations, it may be that our young people will not be able to develop ontorelational modes of thinking. Now, that are adequate. Now, once they do, the next generation or two, they'll find these things very easy, you see. Whereas we find it extremely difficult still.
Okay. Coming from, say, a study of history, where you become very skeptical of saying God intervenes here, God lengthened in the Old Testament, using God as like a trump card for things that you can't explain in history, miracles and things like that. Is there any correlation between that and, say, attributing irregular movements and non-causal things to God?
I think we must think of it in quite a different way. Is that, take the miracles of Jesus. Now, what many New Testament scholars have difficulty is what they call the nature miracles. They will accept some of the other ones, not the nature. Now, I'm the other way around. See, in the sense that if Jesus Christ is really the Word by whom all things are made, the Creator Word, well, when He, the Creator Word, comes into our world where it is disorderly, what does He do? He brings order into it. So the incarnation, the life of Jesus, is not only a disruption of order, it's the opposite, you see. It is the ordering, the reordering, the recreating of order where there was disorder. Now, that's the way we have to understand Jesus, theologically. But if you work with a dualist concept and a causalist, mechanistic universe, then all that sort of thing can only be interpreted as a suspension or disruption of physical law, you see, like Locke and Hume. But now we have to think of it in quite a different kind of way. But this does depend, however, upon recovering in a radical way the point you made about contingency. Someone over here raise it first, and then we'll just have the end. Yes?
I was wondering if light is as dynamic as we postulated it, and can we ever arrive at a point of certainty with respect to the effects and properties without at least postulating some type of uncertainty principle in that it's light is as dynamic? And that it's always been, the particles are always in relationship with that view of light interacting with space and time. How can we be certain or arrive at a point of certainty or reference point if this is a dynamic relationship?
Well, that doesn't matter.
Don't we have to stand under that relationship and allow that whole dynamism to more or less explain itself? And therefore, there's always a state of uncertainty about it as to the possibility that it will not react or not there will not be an occurrence such as we have predicted.
Well, I think that, if I may say so, I think there's a confusion between two things here. You see, uncertainty is in this sense that all our thought is uncertain. I quote Einstein again, mathematical propositions are certain, they're not true. They're true, they're not certain. All our thought is uncertain in that sense. And there's no doubt that because all thought is revisable, it is uncertain. But if it weren't revisable, it wouldn't be true. It wouldn't be touched with reality. So there is that kind of uncertainty that's built into it. But The Göttingen people claim that uncertainty is an inherent property of nature. Now that is the problem. Lanzan said, no, it cannot be. My whole soul revolts against that, and you are confounding the way in which you explain your scientific experiments, confounding that with an actual description of nature, and that's not right. And I'm sure you're dead right at that point. Now, if you come to the, if you ask, is nature uncertain in itself, or indeterminate in itself, then, as I've argued, you're still speaking about determinism in the back of your mind. Now, and Einstein gave up, Heisenberg gave up that point. He said, while he believes that there is something here in nature, a connection, a behavior, which he had called uncertainty or indeterminacy, he said, we cannot, the relation here is so subtle and flexible, more subtle and flexible than we'd realize, and we cannot speak of it in terms of indeterminism, determinism, chance, necessity. Now that was right, but he didn't say what it was. Now my argument is that that is what we mean by contingent order. And so at this point I think theology can contribute something even to quantum theory. And in fact, one of my students has actually applied certain aspects of theology to solving certain problems in quantum theory, at of course a different level. He's now a professor in Hope College in Michigan. And now that time has passed, so we must stop.